The Sunday Grill on Beat 102-103.
My first guest is a West Waterford resident. He's living with Parkinson's disease at a very young age. Ian O'Brien was diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's disease 5 years ago at the age of 37. The father of two joins me in studio this morning to tell us about life with Parkinson's and about the challenge he is taking up to raise funds. And to say it is some challenge is not an understatement, isn't it?
Thanks very much for having me. It's good to be here.
So how are people in your life feeling about this challenge before we describe it? Are you veering towards the, are you a bit cracked stage?
Or? Totally are you a bit cracked. Okay. Totally. Definitely 100%. Could you not just do one, or could you not? I'll explain what that means in a minute. Yeah.
Yes, because there isn't just one. We're in the kind of 30s, are we?
Yeah, so basically the challenge I've taken on is to climb the highest point in each of the EU 27 countries and the UK. So it's 28 countries in total. To climb them all in 28 days.
Okay, so a mountain a day.
It's a mountain a day. Now, being honest, not all are mountains, because you take Denmark and Holland and stuff like that, they don't have the biggest mountains. Some are quite large, and the biggest being Mont Blanc.
And what are we talking about metres-wise? What's Mont Blanc?
Mont Blanc's 4,808.
Okay, well done. And what's the lowest that you're
doing? The lowest is Denmark. It's 171 metres.
Oh, nice. Yes.
Yeah,
so you'll do two of those.
That's a day off.
Yeah, that's your day off. Okay, talk to us. Let's go back to 5 years. Yeah. What was going on with your life that you went to a doctor and finally got diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's?
I was in a very dark place. Parkinson's manifests very differently in everyone, you know, and there's 50, 60 symptoms, and everyone can present with an early different symptom. So for 2 or 3 years leading up to my diagnosis, anxiety and depression were my main symptoms, you know, and you'd never think about putting anxiety and depression with Parkinson's. Yes, I was starting to develop some movement issues, but I never put them all together. So I went to my local doctor, and he put me on some antidepressants for that. And kind of, you know, I didn't even mention the movement things. I didn't really feel it was an issue at the time. And then I went to a friend of mine who had, he was a physical therapist, about some of the movement. And I had broken my wrist previously, and I thought my right hand wasn't, you know, it was related to the wrist being broken. Like, to explain what would happen, I'd be writing a sentence and my hand would just stop. So I'd catch my left hand, push my right hand to finish the sentence. And taking keys out of my pocket and stuff like that was quite difficult. So I got him to check my wrist, and he said, yeah, no, it's all fine. And I just said in a passing comment that, you know, it's like my brain tells my hand what to do and it doesn't do it. Most people with Parkinson's have a particular side that's affected. And so my right hand, so I catch my right hand and push it to do what I wanted to do. Or, like I said, take keys out of your pocket or something like that. It was quite difficult. So,
and what did you think it was? Or did you think it was anything?
I just put it down to breaking that wrist 5 or 6 years previously, you know. And I thought it was a nerve issue or something like that, you know. Carpal tunnel syndrome was mentioned. And so my friend is a physical therapist. When I went to him, and he checked over everything, and he said, no, it's fine. And I just said in a passing comment, it's like my hand, or my brain tells my hand what to do and it doesn't do it.
Okay.
And I saw his face change very professionally, and I'll go back to that in a minute. He said, look, just go back to your GP and tell him you want to see a neurologist. Now, I'm going to be honest, I didn't really know what a neurologist was. I thought it was something to do with nerves and stuff like that. So went back to my GP and I said, look, I have anxiety and depression, and I have this movement with my arm, I want to see a neurologist. And he tried to talk me out of it. He tried to admit, say, you know, up the medication and go to a different physio. And I persisted, and at the time I said, no, I want to see, you know, a neurologist and a psychiatrist, actually. And the first person I saw was the neurologist, the first appointment I got. And I went in all happy and, you know, said, you know, the hand isn't moving right. And at the end of it, he said, I think you've Parkinson's.
Like that?
Just
in
like
that first appointment?
Yeah, in that first appointment.
And did you know about Parkinson's? Like, we kind of have a preconceived about Parkinson's.
Yeah.
That it's for older
It's an
people.
Old person's. Yeah. And I had an old relation that had it.
Yeah.
And he said, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine, I'm fine. And the shock was there. And I walked out and I sat in my car outside and I just cried, you know.
Because what does it mean? It's life limiting more than a terminal disease.
It's not a terminal disease. You don't die from Parkinson's. Okay. And like my first question to the neurologist at that time was, would you have anxiety and depression? Straight away was the first question I asked. And he said, yeah. That was actually a weight off my shoulders.
Yeah.
You know?
And that can be treated.
Yeah, and that can be treated. You know? So in some ways it was like a bit of relief, and then the shock kind of kicked in. But yeah, I cried for most of the rest of that day. And that was the next day after that, I said, right, pull yourselves together, you know? And I did and kind of moved on from there. And I'm probably happier now than I was then. You know?
And 5 years in, have you changed? Like, have you seen a progress?
Yes, definitely. Like I used to say, every day takes a tiny little piece off you.
Okay.
Something you notice every day. But then things like exercise can reverse it. Amazingly, like, you know, I'll notice when I'm not exercising that, you know, I'm a bit more rigid and stiff and
can't move a bit as freely.
Like, the cutting the sandwich is a big thing for me. I make the kids' lunches every day morning. I've only two kids, it takes me 4 to 5 minutes to make the lunch. But I kind of judge, it's a good judge for me if it, you know, if I make it in a half an hour and I'm having a good day.
You're not getting out of that, you're going to do it.
My wife makes sure I do it, so I have no way of getting out of it. But yeah, so definitely exercise can help. Mm. Yeah, it takes a small bit off you every day. And like I mentioned earlier, there's up to 50, 60 different symptoms.
Mm.
And everyone's affected differently, you know. So.
And are you seeing more symptoms now? Or?
Yeah, they start coming on. I'm starting to see a speech therapist because some of my speech can be affected.
Okay.
There's movement. So there's motor and non-motor symptoms, you know. I'm lucky. I don't have an... So when people think Parkinson's, they think someone's shaking.
Mm.
I don't have a huge tremor as such. I do have rigidity, suffer from fatigue, balance wouldn't be great. Going climbing mountains and having balance isn't a great mixture, but you know, I'll try and get over that. But there's things you can work on, you can work on everything, you know. You're not going to cure it, but you can certainly help it.
Yeah, great. And as you said, exercise is helping you.
Huge.
And you weren't a mountain climber before your Parkinson's diagnosis. Tell us about that first person you were talking about, your friend who is the physical therapist.
So yeah.
Where did he bring you?
So basically, when after seeing the neurologist, I went back to him and said, look, I have something to tell you. I said, I have Parkinson's. He said, not the worst. He said, not the worst, you know.
That's nice to hear.
There's worse out there. And
That must have been good to hear, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was. It definitely was. And he said, what are you doing next Saturday? I said, I don't know why. He goes, come on, we're going down to Kerry. We're going climbing Carron Tool.
And he wouldn't have just brought you to the Cumaras or something.
What?
To do a hard one.
Yeah, so we went down, spent the night down there and climbed it the next day. And it was amazing, you know. And I kind of obviously, there's a bit of a metaphor that, you know, I got on top of Ireland and get on top of my diagnosis.
Yeah.
And it just started from there. I just started climbing mountains and not huge mountains, just getting out in the open and, you know, getting lost up the Dublin Mountains or getting lost in the Cumbers and finding your way and stuff like that. And the exercise element of it, the getting out in the open, had so many beneficial effects, you know. Such a benefit for me at the time, and it's continued to be a benefit for me.
You obviously are still doing it, so you must enjoy it. But there's something a little bit, I don't know, fatiguing for anyone about going up very steep hills. Yeah. Did you find that tough?
Again, back to the exercise element of it, you know. And then I suffer from fatigue. Like, I don't work anymore.
Mm.
All right. It's one of the things I decided to do. Stress brings on all the symptoms an awful lot. And I had my own business in Dublin a few years ago, and I sold that on. And that was another weight off my shoulders. Uh-huh. I literally used to come home from work and fall in the door and fall asleep on the floor. You know, the fatigue. So that's gone. And the fitter I get, the better I'm able to manage that. I used to always have to have a sleep during the day. I'd fall asleep for 2 hours during the day. I can get over that now if I'm exercising and stuff like that. Sometimes I'm still not off. But, you know, the exercise, again, I keep going on about the exercise. It really, really helps.
But
you know? Like, I take medication as well.
Mm.
I take 6 different tablets a day. But the exercise is probably the best medicine I take.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, let's talk about this challenge, because it's incorporating that first experience going up Carrigtwohill, which is Ireland's highest
is 1,000.
So you're doing that one now, or are you just moving?
That'll be the last.
Okay.
That'll be the last. It'd be nice to come home and
do
one where it all started, and obviously finish in my home country as well.
Okay, so you've given yourself 28 days. When are you heading?
So at the end of May, I'll go over to Chamonix in France.
Okay.
And I have a kind of bit of a week's training there. And basically, I'll hit the top of Mont Blanc on the 5th of June.
Okay, so that's the highest
clock
one.
Clock starts then.
And you're just taking the hardest one first then, are you?
Yeah, for two reasons. One, just get it over and done with.
Yeah,
and
good idea.
Two, that week training and been there, and it's probably the most, the longest one to acclimatise for and get to the top of. And I'm going to start the clock when I get to the top of that one.
Okay.
So then it'll roll on from there.
Okay. And so, anywhere in particular that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, there's a few.
Apart from the easy ones, obviously.
There's a few. They're not, so hitting Mont Blanc, you're actually hitting France and Italy at the same time.
Okay, great.
Because they both share the top, so it's a little bonus there, okay. You know, gives me an extra day or
three
so.
Three in one, yeah.
Exactly. The next one I'm going to is out to the Azores Islands.
Oh, gorgeous.
Which is a Pico Island, Mount Pico. Really looking forward to that. Somewhere different, somewhere I never would have went unless I was doing this challenge. So that'll be nice. And then to Tenerife to do Mount Tita. Some of these mountains have cable cars, so halfway up and stuff like that. I will be using them. Any public transport that's available, I'll be using them. And then there's Romania, Bulgaria, Greece. I've done Greece last year, which is really, really good.
And such different climates as well that you'll be experiencing.
Yeah, like then later on, I'm going up to above the Arctic Circle to do Sweden and Finland.
Okay.
So even though it's June, it'll still be quite cold and snow and all that up there.
And anyone joining you along the way?
Lots of friends. I'm very lucky. I have a great network of friends and family as well. So there'll be lots of people, and probably depending on people as I go, to do driving for me, to do kind of assistance along the way, and to join me on the treks. So different people join me on different points.
Brilliant.
Climb different mountains.
And what about the two girls and your wife as well? Will they be at home?
My wife's going to do car and tools. She'll always be at home mind the kids. The girls, they're 5 and 8. Yeah, they're going, "You're going away for 5 weeks? I go, yeah. Why? Why can't you go and climb the mountain like you normally climb? You know, so they haven't got their heads around it.
I know. You know. Well, you're doing it all, you're funding it all yourself.
Yes, I'm funding it all myself.
So that means any money that's raised will go straight to charity.
Look, it's an adventure for me and my friends. So, like, you know, it's something I'm interested in. So I'm willing to pay for that element myself. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully everything that people donate will go directly to the charity EOPD.
And so that's a charity you set up yourself.
Yeah, so EOPD stands for Early Onset Parkinson's Disease. And basically, back to what we mentioned earlier, it's perceived as an old person's disease. Like if you Google Parkinson's disease, you just get pictures of old people bent over and shaking and stuff like that. So trying to change that perception. It can be a kind of lonely place when you get diagnosed and, you know, meeting people maybe at a further advanced stage, you know, it mightn't really help you to deal with it. So we think that there's definitely a charity warranted there to deal, you know, to help younger people. There's a lot of issues that come up, like, you know, you're still in work, how do you tell your kids? Mm. You know, there's lots of things like that. So we founded a charity and nearly 2 years ago during COVID. And it's going from strength to strength.
Brilliant.
Unfortunately, it's going from strength to strength when you look at it, because the more people that join means that someone else is actually getting diagnosed.
Well, I know.
But look, we're there to help them.
Exactly, and to create a community around this as well. So that charity is eopd.ie, set up by Ian himself, who is living with early onset Parkinson's disease. But if you want to check out the challenge that he has set himself, well, there is a website live, and it is European, but you're spelling it EURUPIAN. Oh, I see what you're doing there now. there's a bit of Ian as in your name there.
Yeah,
so that's
exactly.
European.com. That's EURUPIAN.com. Best of luck with it. You'll deserve a few drinks now on your last hill. Last mountain.
Yeah, I look forward to that last day in Carrington. Meet all my friends and see the family again. So
brilliant. Well, thanks a million for coming into studio this morning, and best of luck with all that training.
Thank you so much.
The Sunday Grill on Beat 102-103.
We're almost done with the month that has the most sweeping generalisations that I've ever heard. The month to give up everything, month of no money, the most miserable month. Well, it's nearly over and it already feels a bit spring-like out there. But before we head into brighter days, let's look back on the month that was January and some of the stories that have made the news. Joining me this morning is Beat's Head of News, Jolene Murphy, and Michelle Heffernan from Beat's Big Lunch. You're both very welcome.
Good morning.
Hello.
Orla.
You're both very good to come in on a Sunday morning as well.
But like that there, the mornings are getting brighter, Orla,
yes.
So I might as well come and say hello.
I love
Keep
it.
You company.
Exactly. Have you a sweeping generalisation, January? Experience, you know, did you do dry January? Did you go exercising mad?
I was broke. That's a generalization. But also, I think me and Michelle were talking about before that everybody has to get up and go and start new things and go to the gym and get active. But everybody else in nature is in hibernation.
Yeah, I saw this great Instagram post that was like, all of nature is hibernating now.
So why aren't you?
This is a cold and difficult month. So do things to make it easier. Exactly. Do not start new activities and routines when this is so hard.
And I have fully embraced that. It does make you feel guilty. Okay, let's talk about some of the things that happened in January. And apart from spare, I found it very difficult to remember January. Let's talk spare. And I'm interested in talking to you, Michelle, because I am a little bit caught in the rabbit hole when it comes to the royals. Oh, I follow them on Instagram. I follow the prince and princess.
I have zero interest, you know. And it's funny, I will engage in the conversation in the office, but I'll just sort of have this confused look all the time because I don't understand why you would feel an affinity with somebody that you've never had a personal relationship with. Or even, I suppose,
I'm intrigued
if someone that you don't have a sense of emotional relationship with, because I understand why you might feel close to certain celebrities. So if you watch a movie with a certain actor in it, or if you listen to a song, like I love Taylor Swift. And, you know, I really read into some of her lyrics. So, yes, I would be interested in what does Taylor think about this and what has Taylor's experience been? But when it comes to the royals, I have nothing to base a personal affinity on. So I don't understand the fascination.
I'm fascinated because I'm really intrigued by people who generationally come from like third, fourth, fifth, more obviously, families that have been called kings and queens and that they are just, they don't live any life compared to ours. You know, in the disadvantage in that they don't have much freedom at all, but and these massive advantages as well that people do cow down to them, obviously.
So is it just
intrigued by that?
It's a sense of deep diving into another world.
Into another world. I'm being really intrigued by that world.
It's fantasy and escapism as well to look up at. It's a different type of celebrity.
But I suppose I understand that in the case of Diana, because I felt that she embodied something to be admired. And she had the, I suppose, sense of grace and kindness that we might have associated with someone in that particular role. But because as time went on, we seemed to see these royals with, I suppose, dislikable traits. I didn't understand then why they still managed to gain such a following, because to me, they just weren't people to look up to.
Yeah. I don't even know if it's about looking up to them.
But it's also, it's a generational thing as well. Like, their people look up to them for so long because they're the closest we have to a royal family over the pond.
Yeah.
You know, like that Diana, and people come to visit. From my perspective, for any royalists that I know, they follow them because their parents did or their grandparents did.
Yeah, okay.
And I know some people, like, they only have any interest because of the crown, like me. But the royalist's friend that I have
actually went royalist.
She's self-proclaimed royalist, won't watch the crown because she's such a royalist. She's like, no, I respect
them
as they are.
That's really interesting because it was the crown that made me somewhat for the first time interested in the monarchy, but purely from this historical and political analysis, and I got to understand, okay, this is why this is actually such a big deal and this is why these people and their actions are such a big
deal. And I'm also very intrigued by how they have cousins everywhere. So at some stage, you know, this aunt married this king in Germany. But I do watch the royals a bit like I watch Real Housewives for the mania, which is why I was really intrigued by Spare. I'm not going to read Spare because I don't read
nonfiction. Do you think, though, in that sense, it's kind of trauma porn? You are getting off on the scandal of someone else's life.
But it's not just scandal.
One way to put it. The scandal and
I think
intrigue.
Most of my reality show watching is that.
Yeah.
So maybe.
Okay.
No, but also, it's not just that. It's the fashion and the.
Okay, no,
the
I family do ties love the fashion.
And, all that
glamour.
As well.
Okay. You know, look, I'll reserve judgment.
Let's move on to something completely different, but I'll just ask this question quickly. Is anyone here going to read Spare?
No.
No, me neither. And I am the person.
Categorically,
I know. I watched the interview, I watched the Harry interview, and I watched the Netflix series. I felt sorry for them and was on their side for the next Netflix series. Then I watched the ITV interview. No longer I'm on their side. Well, I don't even know where I am, so let's move on.
But would you be dying to interview them? Would you love to sit down with him yourself?
No.
The hesitation said it all.
Because you know why? Because I don't think he'd give much. I think, you know, I do think he's telling his story, but I don't think it's And it is a particularly deep story for him. I think he's a deeply traumatised human
boy,
being.
Yeah.
But I don't think I would get much more out of that.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you're like, I'm over. I'm over him.
Quickly, yeah. Just on the royalist thing, I know somebody who won't buy the book because they were such big royalist fans of the likes of Diana.
Yeah.
To have all of it put out in public, they said, no, not giving him any money, not going to read
Jolene,
it.
Jolene, you have a lot of royalist friends.
Don't tell my family.
And then a Scorthy. Who knew? Let's move on to Argos. Now, when I was a child, there was no Argos. And to me, Argos was bright and shiny. And I remember someone brought the catalogue back from England and I really wanted this porcelain bulb that was held by a white hand. It was hideous. I wanted it so badly. Now it's closing. And, you know, I have to say I don't use Argos that much, but it does feel like a bit of an end of an era, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So every birthday that was celebrated when I was a child, you would go straight to the Argos catalogue and you would get this really tacky necklace that said Best Friends.
Yes. From their special jewellery shop.
Yeah. And then for Mother's Day, it would be this tacky gold necklace that said Mom with a Heart. And I thought that she would love it. And then, you know, when it came to your bedroom, like if you had the groovy chick inflatable chair or the mini fridge that was this like Coca-Cola can from the Argos catalogue.
Or the
like,
Playboy Bunny wallpaper.
Oh my God, you were so cool. And I had hours of entertainment leafing through that catalogue.
That and Christmas for your birthdays. For the likes of people in poor old Enniscorthy, they didn't have an Argos, even in County Wexford for years. So my first memory was being like eyes level to the counter, watching my sister with the little pen fill out the little piece of paper.
Paper,
flicking through the book and then going up to the counter. Like that's my first memory, is the one in Waterford City Square and going down there was a big deal to go to Argos. And even now thinking I needed to get something for my dog, it was like a little pen, it's like a rabbit run. I was thinking before Christmas I must get that now, but I'm thinking I'm not going to get anything like it. It's definitely in Argos, this is not a plug, but things like that that you're like, oh, I'll definitely get it there. You won't have that anymore.
No, kids are not going to experience that really weirdly nice feeling of picking something out of a catalogue, writing down the numbers,
or just,
and then going in and collecting
it. Do you know what
it
is? It's similar to the royals. It's sort of just dreaming.
Yes.
It's kind of like dream, you know, it's just escaping reality. Like, I'd have that and then I'd put that in the corner of my bedroom and I'd get those fancy lights and I'd
get those
on the stairs.
I'd get those portable phones and I remember it all came in sections.
Yes.
You know, I loved that as well. They were very organised, but they are no more, unfortunately. And our final story this morning is, I love the buzzwords and they come thick and fast now, mostly thanks to TikTok, I think. And the latest one, New Year, New Buzzword, is Nepo Babies. Now, it was coined in 2022, but Gen Z have embraced this. And in fact, I saw a tweet where someone didn't realise that, like, a very obvious person was a Nepo Baby, for example. So it is Gen Z are really uncovering all these to their own amusement. This has always been a thing.
But
nepotism has been alive and well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny how, you know, like you said, an old topic re-emerges from Gen Z simply because they managed to put a hashtag to it. But what I found curious about this trend is that it focuses very much, I suppose, on celebrity privilege when really the privilege exists in all sectors, you know.
Yeah.
So while my parents are not famous, maybe my dad would disagree with that, I would have to acknowledge that I came from a certain amount of privilege to end up in the position that I'm in now, you know? Yeah. So I think, I suppose I kind of find it pot calling kettle black if you're saying, well, this person shouldn't, you know, be this successful or be this wealthy, or they're only that way because of their parents. Couldn't we all say that in some sense?
And we only know them because of their parents as well. I actually had to Google the word Nepo Baby. Like, what is Nepo? Why am I seeing this everywhere? It sounds really negative. Like
Nepo.
Yeah. No, nepotism. That's what it is. Even I was reading it Nepo Baby before when I saw it first.
I do think it must be really frustrating if you're in the arts and you see someone who never had to work for 10 years in a cafe or work three jobs just so they could go to auditions.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny that with Timothée Chalamet, for example, when the rumours started flying that he was going to be in Gladiator, his agent said that he hadn't auditioned for a role in 7 years.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Which just goes to show.
Is he a Nepo baby?
Yeah, his parents are in the industry.
Okay, but they're not super famous.
But he would have been sent to that school of arts that Lourdes, Madonna's daughter,
so
was in.
So that's more about privilege of
it's
being
very
able to
much,
go to those places.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so,
and not having to audition for 7 years
to get a role. Know, so he didn't have to go through the same hoops that other people do to break
into the
industry.
Whereas the Zoe Kravitz and the Maya Hawkes of the world I think they're seen as the real true nepo babies because their own parents, you know, Lenny Kravitz.
Were very big celebrities, yeah.
Yeah, and what's Maya Hawke's parents?
Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke, wow, double whammy. Yeah. They're so super famous. I do think that, like, the one nepo baby that I'm thinking of who is getting, like, blasted for his ridiculousness and probably isn't that talented, and I feel very sorry for him because he's really trying, is Brooklyn Beckham. Like, his recipe. Like, I shudder. And I think that's what
I
it all goes
I think people just want to pile on him, though. I mean, yes, he's not asking to be a celebrity, but, you know, Vogue magazine then gives him some level of coverage and people buy the magazine to read it. And then they all just, like, pile on this abuse on him simply because he accepted the opportunity to speak to a publication, you know?
I suppose as well, he seems to jump from career to career. He was a photographer. Now he's trying to be
some sort
of
budding chef. But at any
opportunity,
people would take him down as well. Yes. No matter what he did, I'd say if he, like, solved, you know, all the problems in the world, they'd still have a problem to say, like, oh, it's because he's Brooklyn Beckham.
I mean, at the end of the day, he didn't ask to be born.
Well, you can say that about Prince Harry as well.
You can say that about any of us. I mean, I watched this great TED talk once, and it was from a supermodel. I can't remember her name.
Oh, I saw that, about her being born beautiful.
She was talking about, how, you know, people would come up to her and ask about how they wanted to be a model. And she would say, I'm in this position for two reasons, lottery and legacy. Yeah. And she said, I won a genetic lottery. And I happen to be alive at a time when this particular look is popular. And the same can be said for us and for those celebrities, that they were born into certain circumstances and the talents that they have to offer happen to be in demand. And we happen to be willing to pay for it, you know. So really, like, if you have something against that, I think you need to take a look at yourself, because, you know, you definitely exist on a certain amount of privilege and you don't know it either.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, there's a whole thesis in that and we don't have enough time for a thesis. Jolene Murphy and Michelle Heffernan, thank you so much joining me this morning and talking about January. And I'll talk to you in February.
Woo!
The Sunday Grill on Beat 102-103.
It's the Sunday Grill here on Beat 102-103, and Allianz Insurance and Women's Aid have come together to create the Stand Strong movement, which aims to engage, educate and empower the people of Ireland to help end domestic abuse, and in doing so raise much needed funds for Women's Aid to support women and children in need across the country. One in four women are subjected to domestic abuse in Ireland by a current or intimate male partner. To tell us more about the Stand Strong movement and how you can get involved, Ruth O'Dea is a training manager at Women's Aid and she joins me this morning. You're very welcome, Ruth.
Good morning, Orla.
Good morning. Talk to me about the idea that domestic abuse in Ireland is a societal issue. What does that mean?
Really, what that means is that domestic abuse affects so many women in Ireland that chances are that people, the average person, will know somebody who's been impacted by abuse. They may not know that they know that person, but likelihood is that through their daily life, we are all going to be interacting with survivors, and how we react as a society, you know, as a community, and how we show our solidarity with those women is really, really what that phrase means. You know, domestic abuse impacts on a woman's life in so many different spheres, on her ability to work, her ability to move around freely in society, you know, her liberty, her physical well-being, and actually, in the most the worst circumstances, her right to life. So it is a societal issue and a grave social issue.
We've really spoken a lot about domestic abuse since COVID, really, since the pandemic, because there was that whole conversation about how dangerous the pandemic and lockdown was for women who were being subjected to domestic abuse. Has it become a more open conversation now because of that, or is it still something that we don't really speak of?
There is a bit of more openness now in society around the issue of domestic abuse. One thing that we've noticed in the last two to three years is that employers are becoming much more aware of this as a workplace issue and are looking to support their employees under the employee wellbeing umbrella. They're saying, well, look, we want to stand with our employees and help them. And if something that we can do in the workplace by being, you know, disclosure friendly, by offering some paid leave, you know, by being a source of support for a victim during that time, we want to do that. So that's something that I think did come out of COVID, because a lot of employers' awareness was raised when they had to say to their employees, either your job is not here or please work from home. And then they start to see that the lines between home and work and became kind of blurred, and they start to see things that they were concerned about. So that awareness has increased in that period, and employers are a case in point.
Mm-hmm. Last year I spoke to a Wexford woman who was part of the Women's Aid and Alliance Group World's Strongest Woman campaign, and she spoke about being in a toxic and emotionally abusive relationship at a very long, a young age, in her teens, with an ex-partner. It really got me thinking then that, like, we really have, or do we have, a preconceived idea about what domestic abuse is?
I think we do. I think there are, you know, stereotypes there in people's consciousness, where they see, you know, the bruised woman, the black eye, the mother, yeah, and usually in a quite a solid relationship, mm-hmm. you know, settled down, married, with children. But actually, you know, abuse can affect anyone at any age in their life. It also can be impacting on older women as well. But for younger women, you know, we've done a survey, quite a large scale survey, in the last couple of years, which showed that 1 in 5 women aged between 18 and 25 had experienced abuse from an intimate partner. And actually, of that figure, that 20% figure, half of them had experienced the abuse before the age of 18. Right. So it's starting quite young. It can be sometimes, an abuse can be in that first relationship that they've ever had, the first romance. Mm. And there's a bit of there can be just, you know, just that lack of confidence and a young person not knowing what's okay, what's acceptable. Is it okay to, you know, am I supposed to share my passwords of my phone with my partner? And suddenly now, as a result of that, I'm seeing that is being used against me, the stuff online about me that I didn't know how it got there, or just surveillance of me, just all these controlling behaviours that happen in abusive relationships that may not actually, he may not raise his hand to her, but the threat of violence is usually there. Mm-hmm. And then this controlling behaviour, monitoring, and sometimes isolating the person from their friends, telling them, you know, you know, I only want to be with you. And that can be normal sometimes in the honeymoon period, but it also, if she can't kind of negotiate that, and she can't, you know, that becomes her world starts to shrink, you know, then that's a cause for concern.
Yeah, totally. And let's talk about the Stand Strong movement at Women's Aid with Alliance Insurance. What do you aim to do with this campaign?
I think it's a brilliant campaign. It's a fundraising and solidarity event, and it's happening on the new bank holiday, mm-hmm. which we think is brilliant, because that's the bank holiday that's being linked to St. Bridget, and you know, we're asking people to come together, or even to do it on their own, but to do the yoga warrior pose, and to use that as a kind of a moment in time to shine a spotlight, and then, you know, donate to Women's Aid, and share, take a photo if you feel comfortable doing that, and share the image if you're on social, use the tag #StandStrong. So it's trying to, you know, it's that thing about shining the light, mm-hmm. raising awareness, raising money, and coming together and saying to women, we're with you, we have your back, we don't accept this.
Mm-hmm. And we've spoken a lot about abuse and what domestic abuse is. And at Women's Aid, when you raise the funds, what do you do then with those funds?
Yeah, well, we run the National Free Phone Helpline, which is a 24-hour service that's free. It's available all across the country, and every, you know, 24/7, anybody can call us at any time, and we will be there for the caller. Most of our callers are women who are subjected to abuse, but we get a lot of calls from family, friends, colleagues, neighbours who are concerned. Also professionals like guards, healthcare professionals, and they're looking for a bit of a steer. They're concerned about somebody, but the women themselves who are calling us, you know, sometimes they're very sure, they're ready to make a move, or mm-hmm. they're looking for refuge. We can then link them into the refuge check which is there a refuge nearby that's got a place, and we can make that direct contact, or with the local domestic violence service if there isn't a refuge in their county. We can also link them into Women's Aid Services if they want to meet us face to face in the greater Dublin area. And we have a drop-in service in Dublin. Then we also provide training to agencies all around the country who are supporting women. So just, you know, for healthcare professionals, guards, community workers, and employers, as I mentioned, we have these public awareness campaigns as well, all the time trying to make sure that we reach the women, you know, who don't look for help, because we know from the research that one third of survivors will never tell anyone about what's happened to them. So that's what we really want to. We want to reduce that number, and we want to make sure that a lot of the time people will ring us and say, actually, I'm not sure if I'm on to the right place. I don't think this is really for me, but I'm a bit, you know, worried about my husband, this kind of thing. So in the course of the conversation, we can bring it back to where they're at and find out what's going on for you. So that's what we use. So we get calls from all over the country, and that's, you know, we also have an instant messaging service if somebody wants to not to call, but to use the chat on their phone or on the website. They can do that, and we will respond then, and can, you know, support the person in that online messaging support, which is really helpful for some people who can't pick up the phone and call, you know.
Totally. And the Stand Strong campaign on February the 6th on St. Bridget's Day, 100% of the funds raised for that will help Women's Aid on all those services that you mentioned. And that's at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week service as well. So you want people to do the warrior pose, put it on their social media. And of course, the warrior pose is strength, focus, confidence and courage with the hashtag StandStrong. And you can get more details from the website. It's standstrong.ie. That's where full details are and ways to donate as well. Ruth, thank you so much for joining me this morning and telling us more about what the great work that Women's Aid does and about the Stand Strong campaign on February 6th.
Thank you, Orla.
The Sunday Grill on Beat 102-103.
Your music now, it's Beat 102-103, and this week was an exciting one for Carlow businesswoman Jo Brown when she opened her first dedicated store at Kildare Village with her business story. Her business story is an inspiring one, and she's on the phone this morning. Hiya, Jo.
Hi, Orla.
Well, congratulations. This is almost a full circle moment for me as well as you, Jo. We've talked a few times, haven't we?
We have, yes, at the very start of the business.
Yeah, and then when you were doing your pre-cleanse and you just added to your products, didn't you?
Yeah, I think we got into so many different shops. We found at one stage we just didn't have enough room space and shelf space. So, yeah, we just kept adding to the brand. So everything I bring out, I formulate myself.
Okay.
Through research on my own. So that's kind of, and I never knew I was able to do that. So it's quite amazing.
Yeah. So I think the first time you were in the Sunday Grill was about 7 years ago with your solid perfume. It was like almost a lip balm that you twist up and it becomes a solid perfume. How would you describe Jo Brown as products? How do you describe it to people?
Yeah. So Jo Brown is a luxury product. It's a sustainable product. Our packaging is in bamboo. So we do body care, we do skin care, we do home accessories, and also now we do the bamboo bedding. So we also use ingredients from the bamboo tree as well. So bamboo is very sustainable. It grows with no pesticides. So the ingredients, then we use bamboo extract in our award-winning facial serum. We use bamboo powder in our RSVP winner body scrub. And then we use bamboo silk in our soap. So it's very sustainable, our company is.
And is that what you thought about when you were starting off? Was sustainability something that was important to you?
Yeah, I could never wear, I suppose, normal spray perfume. So the whole concept of making a solid perfume was very exciting, because I actually was buying it in from Australia. And I just said, oh, I'm a reflexologist. Let's see, can I make a solid perfume? And then I spotted bamboo and I said, imagine if I could put a perfume into that bamboo stick. But then our company has grown so much. Our company is 6.5 years old. And we have so many different products now, which is amazing.
It really is. And now you have pop-ups in Brown Thomas, you're in Arnott's, but you now have your first dedicated store up the road from you in County Carlow in Kildare Village. How did this all come about?
Oh, absolutely amazing. I suppose we did such a good job in Brown Thomas and Arnott's and we were spotted. And then I approached Kildare Village. I mean, walking into Kildare Village, you're with all these high-end brands. And I just said, imagine if I had a shop in Kildare Village. Now I say, oh my God, that's such a dream. But you know what? If you don't go looking, you won't get. And if you don't dream it, you won't get it. You have to have the dream. You really, really do. I'm blown away. So we opened our shop Thursday. It was remarkable. It was amazing. We had a queue and everything coming into the shop. So our biggest, I think, thing will be there is our bamboo bedding. We've lovely bundles put together. We have exclusive stuff for Kildare Village. And it's just amazing working with the Kildare Village staff.
Congratulations. It's just lovely to hear such a good news story early on in 2023 as well. Are you going to be up there a lot yourself or where are you going to be? Do you base yourself at home?
I plan to be there 3 or 4 days a week. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lovely. And lovely to meet your customers as well.
Do you know what? That's what it's all about, meeting the customers. It's been on the ground. It's very important to be on the ground when you own a business and meeting the people that are buying your product.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. You know? Well, look, where will we find you in Kildare Village? Are you easy enough to find? It's a bit of a maze in there. There's so many great shops.
It can be, yeah. So when you go into Kildare Village, you're going to take a left.
Okay.
So we're unit 71 and we're next door to Elemis.
Okay, good to know. That is unit 71 in Kildare Village. But if you want to check out Joe online, it is Joe Brown, and that's Brown with an E. So joebrown.com. And Joe, I know you're so busy. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning and congratulations on the new and the first shop dedicated to Joe Brown products in Kildare Village. It's great to get a Carlow success story. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much, Arla.
The Sunday Grill on Beat 102-103.
Across the southeast, it is Beat 102-103. Now, if anything is finally going to get me to the cinema, I feel you're going to laugh. This is it.
I mean, Orla.
I know.
I wish I could believe you. Honestly, I come in and every week I have a smile on my face and you're saying, I'm going to go see this in the cinema. And I'm like, I can't wait to talk to you about it, Orla, because there's things about it that I can never give away on films. And I hate things getting spoiled for me. And I always just want to talk to you about it. And you're like, I didn't see it. And then 8 months later, you're like, do you know what?
I saw it.
I saw it. I didn't really like it.
I'm
like,
well, you could have told us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But there was something about this trailer. I think Margot Robbie, her character in this, had elements of Harley Quinn again. It was very manic.
Unhinged.
Yeah, unhinged. Yeah. Anyway, the movie, of course, is Babylon. A bit of a snub at the Oscars. Just 3 kind of under the radar nominations. None of the actors nominated. It's the tale of outsized ambition, outrageous excess. Traces the rise and fall in early Hollywood during the time of silent film, when they were kind of coming to an end. Would that be right?
Yeah, it's kind of... Okay, so this is a spoiler.
Well, will I play the clip?
Yeah, we'll do the spoiler. Okay.
Let's do that, and then you can chat.
Yeah.
If you could go anywhere in the whole world, where would you go?
I always wanted to be part of something bigger.
I love that answer.
Something that lasts, that means something. Something more important than life.
It's written in the stars. I am a star. If I had money, I would only spend it on things that were fun, you know? Not boring things like taxes. I just want for everyone to party forever.
When I first moved to LA, signs on all the doors said, no actors or dogs allowed. I changed that.
And now, y'all ready for something different?
You know what we have to do? We have to redefine the form. Map those dreams and print them into history. Look up and say, Eureka! I am not alone.
There you go. Brian has just told me there that this is 3 hours. So everything that I said a minute ago, I take back.
Really? Is it? Oh, no.
I can't do 3 hours in the cinema. That includes half an hour of trailers.
Well, yeah, it depends. Well, I'm already late for it. I normally like to be late enough that I miss the trailers.
Yeah, true.
Trailers then ruin things for me, honestly.
Yeah, I know. But I haven't been to the cinema in so long. Not my own fault. that trailers would excite me.
Yeah, but this, I would say, Orla, is a great film. Like, it's
okay, because this has divided the critics.
I don't care. You don't. Okay. You, we you always say you only have to listen to me.
Yeah.
it's one of those. It's one of those things. So the bit of irony is that, like, in the start of the movie, one of the characters, like Margot Robbie's character and Diego Calva's character, all they want to do is get onto a movie set. Uh-huh. I ironically had was
you are
I was
people.
I was no I was on set and I was like not needed, so I said I'd dip away for a few hours and go to the cinema and saw it, and I was like, that's ironically I left set to go see it, so whatever. But
that's a bit of a humble brag.
I know,
there, Brian
I know,
Griffin.
You know, I know. But I was only sitting around anyway, so it's not as if I was doing anything.
On a student film.
Yeah. It's gonna be good.
No,
it's gonna be good.
Still important. Still important.
But it was a film that I was looking forward to. Like, Damien Chazelle did La La Land, one of the most divisive films I've ever seen.
Completely.
I love it.
I disliked it massively.
Yeah. So it's one of those things, like, people seem to either absolutely love or absolutely hate. Like, uh-huh. There's never someone who's like, I saw La La Land, it was okay.
Yeah, I'd watch it again. Yeah. I wouldn't. No.
I loved it. But so this one, there's a spoiler in what it is.
Oh, okay.
In and it's very cleverly done. Like, if you're a person that loves Hollywood and loves cinema, you're probably going to love this movie.
Okay.
So this was 100% right up my alley. I think Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie are two of the best actors working. 100% made for me, like, you know?
Okay, yeah.
So it's basically a tribute and a remake of Singing in the Rain.
Ah, okay.
So it's essentially what Singing in the Rain was in real life. Like, do you know the way, like, you might say it's a Hollywood version of it? They took out all the bad times and, like, all the, they only left in, like, all the nice parts and made everything else kind of rounded and happy and wholesome. Mm-hmm. Imagine Singing in the Rain, but real, essentially.
Okay. But explain, people who might know Singing in the Rain, what do you mean by that storyline that matches Babylon?
Yeah, so it is. It's the story of, like, Hollywood transitioning from, like, the silent era to the sound era, and, okay, like how actors were kind of thrown out, essentially, because they weren't able to become, like, talky movie stars.
Yeah,
you know,
there's the whole, you know, we've seen it in a few movies, you know, suddenly they realize they have a squeaky voice.
Yes.
And, yeah,
and it's one of those things, and it's like, it was like these and then it's and it's like the jazz singer comes out and it's this massive thing, and then Hollywood is like, oh, we really have to get on this.
Yeah.
And it's,
and
like,
of course we've seen this with The Artist. Was that the movie?
Yeah, that was, yeah,
which was all about the silent era and was a silent movie.
Yeah,
2011. Again, a movie I did not like.
But it was, it's one of those things that, like, it shows Hollywood, like, how you can be the biggest star in the world and then immediately get thrown out, like, your yesterday's news.
Yes, totally.
And it's kind of the sad reality of it in a way. But also, it's like these people that, like, wanted, like, love the magic of it, mm-hmm, and how the magic kind of got destroyed on them a small bit. Mm-hmm. And it's quite sad, honestly. But it is, like, Singing in the Rain through and through, which is quite interesting because I love Singing in the Rain. Uh-huh. So it was like, there was parts of it, and I was like, oh, this is funny because, like, it kind of matches Singing in the Rain.
It looks a bit more decadent than the innocence of Singing in the Rain.
It is. It's like an uninnocent version. Okay. Like, it is crazy. I wouldn't watch it with my mom.
No,
my mom would probably be giving out about it. But
seems to be a lot of nudity in it.
There is a lot of nudity in it. Big thumbs up for me for that. And it's one of those it's one of those things, like, it's like there's drugs everywhere. There's this, that everywhere. It's like the debauchery of Hollywood. But it's like, it looked mad, and it shows how crazy and how churned out things were and how unsafe it was, and there's asbestos everywhere, and, like, the kind of the effect it had on people that stayed, and the effect it had on people that left. It's like how it brushed aside culture and everything. And it's like, at the start of the movie, it's this glorious place of, like, just craziness, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, it's not really glorious. It shows, like, the greatness but also the terribleness of it all.
Bit Boogie Nights-ish.
It is a bit, like,
yeah.
But
yeah,
it was just, honestly, like, it was 3 hours, and I know we're going to say 3 hours long movie. You didn't feel it going, honestly.
Now, is, you know, from watching the clips, and I watched many clips, Margot Robbie just seems to be the standout star of this.
It's kind of one of those things, there's kind of like five separate storylines happening.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
Which is probably why those 3 hours aren't as long for
exactly,
you.
Because you have, like, the kind of the Brad Pitt storyline, the Margot Robbie storyline, the Diego Calva storyline. He's kind of the main one.
Mm.
And then there's two more. It's just kind of like, they're kind of smaller, really.
Yeah.
But it's basically like how, like, the Asian culture and the black culture were kind of pushed out.
Okay.
And also kind of like LGBTQ people were kind of just pushed out of Hollywood. They wanted to have a certain narrative. And it was just kind of mad how these things were pushed out. But it's like to the people, to the public, it's like, oh, these things just happened. But it's like, no, it was these little steps and like these gradual little steps. And suddenly it was this massive thing. But it's just like people die like in every stage of the thing. Like, and they're just like, well, they're dead. We got to get somebody else. And that's all it was. It was like literally like, it's like, it's completely out with the old, in with the new all the time. And it was just amazing to see. I honestly really had a great
time.
And
is it very fast moving?
Yeah, at some stages, you are like, yeah, and it always kind of is because there's always some sort of intense pressure on. And there's always, if it's not in one story, there isn't another.
Okay.
And there's all like you get in with these characters so much, and it's just so, you're so happy for them to achieve things, but you're also so sad to see what happens to them, do you know?
Okay, let's Black Pudding, Babylon.
So I would give it a 9 out of 10.
Wow.
Okay. I really enjoyed it. It was like, I mean, like at 9.3, I'd say. Like it's one of those things where I know my friends wouldn't enjoy it. I know my friend. If I went to my friends, I'm kind of glad I saw it on my own. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. My friends would think it's too long and boring and whatever.
Yeah.
It's just completely ticking all the boxes for me, honestly. So it's just, it's like, I don't know. If you're like mad into kind of Hollywood and how it's, what it's like behind the scenes. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know
it's
what I mean?
For me.
Yeah.
All right. When I talk to you next week, ask me now, did I go see Babylon?
I 100% will.
Maybe give me a couple of weeks. Anyway, we'll see.
Yeah.
That is 9.3. You've never done the fractions before.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's more of a decimal than a fraction.
Oh, it is a decimal. Excuse my maths. 9.3 out of 10 Black Puddings for Babylon. It is out now, starring Margot Robbie, Brad Pitt, and a whole host of stars. Brian, thanks a million.
No bother at all. The Sunday Grill on Beat 102-103.